Hello, Nathan Lowell here. Owner's Share is the culmination of nearly a million words, 6 volumes, and 4 years' worth of work. At nearly 200,000 words, this audiobook comes in at 17 hours of finished audio. There's no way to give a full recap in only an hour, so I've picked a few key points for your consideration. I hope you enjoy them. We docked at Diurnia safely and without incident on the afternoon of December 17th. The mood aboard was more worried than somber. All the crew had seen Jeff Maloney, of course, but I was the only one of them that had significant interaction with him. Even I couldn't say I knew him personally. When we docked, Miss Kingsley met us, coming aboard as soon as we'd cleared Confederation Customs. The tired-looking brunette in a severely tailored suit had a slim portfolio tucked under one arm. The hollows under her eyes made me think that the suit might be the only thing holding her up. I met her at the lock and escorted her to the cabin while Miss Thomas established the portside watch and declared liberty. The crew did not immediately stream off the ship, but rather huddled on the mess deck waiting for news, I suspected. As we settled onto the sofas with a tray of coffee and cookies between us, courtesy of Avery Wyatt's forethought, I thought she blew out a sigh. I must have looked at her oddly. "Sorry, Captain." She accepted the coffee and gave a small, tight laugh. "It's been a very hectic few days, and I suspect it's only going to get worse." "I can only imagine." I gave her a moment to sip her coffee and let her push the tray of cookies away. "How can I help you, Miss Kingsley?" "Kirsten, please." She paused for another sip, or maybe to gather her thoughts before speaking. "As you might imagine, there's a lot going on behind the scenes. A power shift of this magnitude has the sharks circling." I didn't know. The situation was well outside my area of expertise, but I nodded for her to continue. "The company has emergency plans in place to deal with the situation, although we never thought we'd need them. I don't suppose anybody ever does. There's a service on the 18th. Gods, that's tomorrow. Family only and down on the planet, although I'm not sure who all will attend. There's not many of his family here anymore." She took another sip of the coffee, pausing to blow on it a bit first. "The CPJCT will hold a public memorial at their offices here on Breakall and another at Port Newmar." Her face twisted into a grimace. "It's not often they lose one while in service, so they'll play it for all it's worth." "How's the media? Are they pestering crews?" She shook her head. "There were a few who tried to interview crew from the Achilles. She was in port when it happened. No sobbing crewmen, no angry fist shaking, so..." She shrugged and looked at me. "No story." "What'd they expect?" "I don't think they expected anything, truthfully. They were fishing. They were hoping to find some dirt to trot out. A man like Jeff doesn't get to be where he is without making a few enemies." I toasted her with my coffee mug. "That's true enough." She gave me a steady look across the table. "You're not one of them, are you?" "One of his enemies?" She nodded her head slowly. I shook mine in response. "I'm just a captain in his fleet. He was my boss. Nothing much beyond that." For the first time since she came aboard, I saw a flash of humor in her eyes. Right. Sure." "What? Is there something I don't know?" She chuffed out a laugh. "Captain Ishmael Wong, hand-picked by the man himself from the graduating class at Port Newmar, transported to Diurnia in his private yacht. You cleaned up that festering boil that was the William Tinker, worked your butt off to make captain in record time, got assigned the worst ship in the fleet, and in less than a stanner you've turned that ship around from being the berth we threaten people with to the one we have a waiting list to get on." She toasted me with her mug. "Just a captain. Seems to be a bit of an understatement, even for you, Captain Wong." I snorted a short laugh of my own. "I got lucky a few times." "Yeah, well, luck helps, but you've done well, and there are those that think that Jeff Maloney's hand was behind a lot of it." The silence in the cabin grew for a couple of ticks before I shrugged. "I've wondered that myself." "You're about to become very rich. You know that, don't you?" I blinked at the sudden shift in the conversation. She smiled at my confusion. "When the Chernyakhova gets sold, you'll be a millionaire, Captain Wong, several times over." I blew out my breath. I wasn't sure where she'd been going with that line, and my heart seemed to have stopped for a moment. "Oh, yes, well, we don't know how much it'll go for, and I'm not sure what my share of it will be." I gave a half shrug. "I'm trying not to think about it until it happens." The news about Maloney's death had completely tossed all thoughts of the pending salvage auction out of my mind. "Will DST put in a bid?" I asked. She shook her head. "No. Ames is on his way back already. He'll be here in a couple of weeks. Under the circumstances, we're holding up any major changes to the fleet until we get the new CEO up to speed. Who's the new CEO? The new majority stockholder, of course. Christine Maloney. I frowned. That name didn't ring any bells with me. Is that Mrs. Maloney? She shook her head, and I had the uneasy sense that she fought to contain a grin. Mrs. Maloney left Stan years ago, took her settlement and her masseuse off to Venice somewhere. Christine is his daughter, sole heir, 31. Likes her nightlife, I understand. I sipped carefully before speaking. And she's the new CEO? Uh-huh. I glanced over to where Kirsten studied my face over the rim of her cup. What does she know about running a shipping company? Not one damn thing. Why don't you look more worried? I had a very bad feeling about the look she gave me. Because she's not my problem, Captain. She put a slight emphasis on the word my that set off a warning klaxon in the back of my mind. Whose problem is she? Kirsten picked up her mug, sipped without answering, and without taking her eyes off me. I could feel my eyes getting round in their sockets as the implication of what she was not saying began to sink in. She's my problem? The smirk broke free, and Ms. Kingsley gave a little nod. I sat very still, trying to figure out how a 31-year-old woman, heir to one of the oldest shipping lines in the quadrant, could suddenly become my problem. Only one entirely ludicrous explanation seemed possible, and I blurted it even as the thought formed. You want me to train her? The smirk turned into a grin. Right first time, Captain. But I don't know anything about running a shipping line. The grin softened to a smile that I might have found quite charming if I hadn't been so distracted. No, Captain, we want her to learn what it's like on a ship. We? I asked. The board of directors and her father. Maybe you should start from the beginning. She nodded and put her coffee cup carefully on the table. Good idea. She steepled her fingers in front of her nose and mouth and blew out softly, brow furrowed. Mr. Maloney has a deal for you. You're under no obligation to accept it, but he thought, it would be something you'd be willing to take on. This is the same Mr. Maloney who's now deceased? Yes, Captain. Mr. Maloney took some rather extraordinary steps over the last few Stanyers. I leaned back, laying an arm across the back of the sofa. And I figure in those plans. She gave a curt nod. Some of them, Captain, which is why I'm here. She pulled the tab on her portfolio and slipped out large envelopes, placing them carefully on the table beside her mug. Your last performance evaluation of Ms. Thomas was quite complimentary. I frowned and looked at the envelopes. She's come a long way in a Stanyer. Getting her hearing loss diagnosed and treated made all the difference. So did giving her a strong role model. We've had our eye on her for a while. After her last failed board, Jeff dug a little and pulled in a few favors. He used his position to get a copy of the confidential report from her board. I could feel my eyebrows bounce at my hairline. I didn't think that was even possible. When you own the cookie jar, you get your choice of cookies, Captain Wong. She gave me a small smile before continuing. Her last board only failed by the smallest of margins. The crux of it was her abrasive personality and her fitness reports from Captain Delman. I felt my eyebrows return to a more normal line. She's a good officer. The changes in her over the last few months have been remarkable, but I credit that to Avery Wyatt as much as anything. Wyatt, the cargo chief? They're an item. Interesting. Her voice was so low I almost didn't catch it, but she shook her head as if dislodging a fly from her nose before continuing more strongly. At any rate, the string that Jeff pulled got her a new board. She slid the first envelope across the table to me. That's her formal invitation. She's due at CPJCT in the morning. That would have happened regardless, by the way. Events of the last week notwithstanding, we expected to get Miss Thomas her ticket. I smiled happily. That's excellent news. I'd planned to put her up when we pulled in, but I haven't had a chance yet. Now you don't have to wait. We've managed to reconvene her last board. She should have her master's license by the 21st. That bit of news made me blink. How can you be so sure? I know how it works. I'm assuming you're willing to write a letter of recommendation to the board. Well, of course, but I don't see how that'll matter. Between your letter, the late Mr. Maloney's interest, and Miss Thomas's performance review, it should be enough. She has to pass the written exam, which she's done easily more than once. It's not a done deal, but we're pretty sure they'll find in her favor this time. What has this got to do with Christine Maloney and me? She pushed a second envelope across the table. You're fired. She said the words with a broad grin on her face. Her expression didn't match what she'd just said, and the response didn't seem to answer my question. What? She put up both hands in a placating gesture. Hang on, Captain, let me explain. I could barely hear her for the blood rushing in my ears. You've got my attention. Sorry, Captain, that was mean of me. I nodded acceptance of her apology and waited for her to go on. She folded her hands together in front of her. In about 2 weeks, you're going to become very wealthy. According to Ames, the winning bid in the Chernyakova salvage job will come in at around a gig. Your share of that as leader of the prize crew will be substantial, even after the insurance company recovers their slice of the pie. Everyone who was a member of the Tinker's crew at the time will get a good piece. But those of you who served on the prize crew will get the most, after the company, of course. How substantial are we talking about here? I frowned in concentration, trying to knit all the various strands together in my head. Something in the order of 10. 10? 10,000? She smiled and shook her head. 10 million. The number echoed in my mind. I'd hoped that maybe I'd see 100,000 out of it. 10 million credits? I was having a little trouble breathing, and my mind seemed to have stopped processing. Captain Wong, that was the richest prize ever salvaged in Diurnia. Usually when a ship is recovered, it's a burned hulk, or worse. You brought back this ship and the cargo intact. Even after the insurer gets their cut, it's going to be a very large settlement. When the news breaks, the media frenzy will make the death of a shipping magnate disappear like water in a vacuum. But I ran out of steam. I really didn't know what to say. I can put you in touch with some financial advisors. In fact, I'd urge you to hire a tax accountant today if possible. But you're not going to be the only new millionaire in the company. We expect we're going to lose most of the crew of the Tinker, and Captain De Groot will have her retirement eased greatly, not that she was hurting to begin with. Lose the crew? They'll be too rich to want to work for us. I goggled at her. Moving a bit fast. She actually sat back and smiled at me. She looked much older than I first thought. Yes, just a bit. I held up a fist. Let me see if I have these right. I flipped up my index finger. We're pushing Ms. Thomas into the captain's board tomorrow, and you expect she'll have her ticket within a few days. Yes. I added my thumb. I'm fired, so I'm assuming you're planning on giving the Agamemnon to her. Yes, very astute. I added my middle finger to the digital bouquet. You're expecting that I'm going to train your new CEO in how to run a ship so she gets a better appreciation about how to run a shipping company? That seemed like a bit of a stretch to me, and I wasn't sure that's where she was going. Yes and no, Kirsten grimaced. We want you to show her why she shouldn't run the business and convince her to turn over the company to Ames. I blinked at her. She shook her head. No, I said that badly. She screwed up her face and thought. While you're thinking, explain why I'd help you after you fire me. I released my fingers. When I'm no longer on the payroll, what's in it for me? Miss Kingsley nodded. Okay, you've got the main points. Let me walk you through it in sequence. I waved for her to continue and topped off my coffee from the carafe. Mr. Maloney's will stipulates that on his death, his majority interest in DST goes to his daughter, Christine. Because it's not a publicly traded company, she becomes the de facto chairman of the board, because with controlling interest, she can dictate to the board. She's not, yet. And the way the board has always dealt with it, the way Mr. Maloney and his father and his grandfather before him wanted it, was the board provides the fig leaf of corporate legitimacy and the operational control of the company is in the hands of the majority stockholder. It's been a family company for over a century, so the scheme has always worked. I frowned in concentration. As long as there's an heir to the throne. Exactly. There's always been a Maloney in the wings, ready to step up and take the reins. Until now. Until now. Mr. Maloney recognized that about 5 Stanyards ago and set about rectifying the situation by adding a codicil to his will. Christine gets nominal ownership of the stock, but it will be held in trust for 1 Standard year. She's old enough, isn't she? Miss Kingsley's mouth curled in a smirk. Yes, but she has to do something before she can claim the inheritance. She has to get a job on a ship and stick it out for a Stanyard. I could feel my face twist into a mask of confusion. Well, I suspect DST has a few ships that might be willing to take her on. Ah, you see, that's a problem. It can't be one of our ships. What? She can't sign on to any of DST's ships. The power differential and potential for abuse there is just too large. I saw it immediately. What happens if she doesn't take it out? She doesn't get the stock. It reverts to the company with the instructions that DST goes public. The stock gets converted to common, and the board of directors controls that process. She'll get a cash settlement and a block of preferred in the new company, but not controlling interest. DST will cease to be a family company. If that happens, there are a whole set of financial transactions that will occur to clear out some old debt, streamline the operation, and regularize finance. But her inheritance is greatly reduced, is what I'm hearing you say. Yes. Her mouth straightened into a firm line. If she can do it, she gets controlling interest in the company and earns the right to try to run it. If not, Miss Kingsley shrugged, she'll still be rich, but not as rich and certainly not as powerful as she'd be otherwise. And Ames Jarvis? He's given his life to this company. He's seen the good times, the bad times, and all the other times. He'll be interim CEO for the next Stanier, and if she fails to work the Stanier out, then he's a shoo-in for the post. The board likes him, and he'll be a great CEO. She sighed and shook her head. If she can run the company, then okay. But at the moment, she's a spoiled rich kid who's going to have a straight shot at the cookie jar. We have a Stanier to prove to her that she's not ready to step into Daddy's shoes. Now, where do I fit into this? Well, Captain, you're about to become independently wealthy and beached. The smart money would bet you'd buy a ship of your own and go indie. I snorted. I've priced ships. Even used, they're not cheap. And there's insurance, pay, papers, cargo. The tab is pretty steep. But you thought about it. She nailed me with her eyes. I thought about it. DST is in an odd position, Captain Wong. We've lost our leader, and we're going to be fat on cash. In a few weeks, we're going to have at least two-thirds of the crew of the William Tinker retire, and those are going to be people who are hard to replace in the short term. Some of the officers will stay, and probably some of the senior ranks. Captain Delman, of course, since he's not eligible for prize money. I nodded, still not sure where this long and winding path led. We're planning to consolidate crews, mix, match, and hire where we can, but we anticipate that we'll be putting a ship up for sale. What kind of ship? Funny you should ask. She grinned at me. Want to take a walk? Mirania Orbital, December 26, 2372. The press conference started off smoothly, or perhaps it only seemed so after the tense few ticks beforehand. I still wasn't sure I'd done the right thing, but that was becoming an ongoing theme in my life. In the end, only a few newsies showed up, and they accepted the platitudinous statements of William Simpson announcing the new shipping line and the key role that Lark, Simpson, and Green had in putting the deal together. I stood up and said how grateful I was for the financial support of Lark, Simpson, and Green and thanked my unnamed backers. I said something about looking forward to getting underway soon and how exciting it was to start forth on a new adventure. Mr. Simpson stood beside me, and they took digitals of us shaking hands. He presented me with a gavel, representing my taking the seat as chairman of the board, so they took digitals of that. Finally, Mr. Simpson turned to the group, clustered about the front of the room, and said, "Well, if there are no questions..." "I've got one." A smartly dressed woman with perfectly coiffed hair held up her recorder. Mr. Simpson seemed surprised by the interruption, but smiled at her in what I thought was a genuine smile. "Yes, you are?" "Madeline Burgess, Diurnia News Service." "Oh, yes, Madeline. You did that piece on Kavanaugh's last week, right?" "Yes, sir." It was her turn to look surprised. "Nice piece. My congratulations." "Oh, thank you, sir. What's your question, Madeline?" She refocused her attention on me. "Captain, you picked the name Icarus for your new company?"
"I did, Miss Burgess, yes."
"That seems an odd name for a shipping company, Captain. Didn't he crash and die?" The rest of the newsies went silent, refocusing their recorders on me. "Icarus is an ancient myth about a man who overstepped his bounds, Miss Burgess. In order to escape the tyrannical rule of King Minos of Crete, his father created two pairs of wings. The wings were wonderful constructions of wax and feathers, but fragile. His father cautioned him to stay high enough above the sea that the feathers did not get wet, and low enough below the sun that the heat didn't melt the wax. On the appointed day, they took wing and soared. Icarus, becoming enraptured with his ability to fly, soon forgot his father's warnings and flew higher and higher, reveling in his ability to soar like a bird.
Unfortunately, he flew too high and didn't pay attention to what he was doing. The heat of the midday sun melted the wax holding his wings together, and he plunged into the sea and died. I paused and looked around at the newsies. I hope that by listening to good advice and paying close attention to what I'm doing, I'll be able to learn from the story of Icarus and soar. I looked down at Ms. Burgess. She had an oddly cynical smile on her face. That seemed like a rather practiced answer, Captain, she said archly. The question wasn't entirely unexpected, Miss Burgess. She grinned and tipped her head in acknowledgement while the other newsies laughed softly behind her. A male voice rose out of the hubbub. I got one. A hand waved near the back of the small crowd, and a tall, skinny man with a familiar face focused his recorder. I smiled at him. Mr. Allen, is it? The other reporters looked confused, and he shook his head. You've apparently mistaken me for someone else, Captain. As you say, sir. You are Robert Parkins, Independent News? Mr. Simpson frowned and stood up beside me. You're a bit off your beat, aren't you, Bob? He laughed easily and shook his head. Not necessarily. You know who you've got there. Yes, I do, Bob, but what's your question? He turned back to me. You're the fellow who found the Chernyakova, aren't you, Captain? I shook my head. Sorry, Mr. Parkins, you've apparently mistaken me for someone else. The reporters all laughed as I echoed his words back to him. When the laughter died down, I continued. The Chernyakova was never missing, so I couldn't have found it. But you're the man that returned the ship to Baikal, aren't you? He seemed peeved that I was puncturing his balloons. That's correct, Mr. Parkins. Diurnia Salvage and Transport filed a salvage claim on the ship, and I led the prize crew that sailed her back to Baikal. A ship full of corpses, Captain. The reporters murmured among themselves, and Parkins enjoyed the effect his words had. I'm not really at liberty to discuss that, Mr. Parkins. I'm sure if you query the TIC, they'll be happy to give you all the public information available. He seemed frustrated and tried a different approach. How does it feel to be founding your company on the blood of fellow spacers? Everybody in the room went silent. Excuse me? He gave me a smarmy smile. Well, Captain, seems to me you couldn't afford this venture without the prize money you got from salvaging the Chernyakova. They all died, and now you're making the profit. How does that make you feel? I stood and looked at him for a full tick. You realize your question is irrational, don't you, Mr. Parkins? Before he could answer, I turned to Mr. Simpson. William, you have my permission to tell the group on the record exactly how much money I have received to date from the salvage of the Chernyakova. Would you do that, please? He frowned, but shrugged. Certainly, Captain. He made a show of pulling up his tablet and holding it up to his face, squinting dramatically. According to my records, not one single credit. A confused buzz went around the room, and even Mr. Parkins looked flustered. That's impossible. That's impossible, he objected. Mr. Simpson looked up and smiled. Actually, it's quite factual. The auction for the Chernyakova doesn't close for another dozen stands or so. That auction occurred on Baikal, and it would surprise me greatly if we even find out how much the salvage is worth before the 28th. Parkins wasn't quite done. But you underwrote this deal based on that money coming in, Simpson. Mr. Simpson turned a cold look and waited for the buzz to calm down. Now that, Mr. Parkins, is a falsehood, uttered in public in front of witnesses. I'm under no obligation to justify that remark, and I might take umbrage if I thought you intended to impugn my character or that of Larks, Simpson, and Green. Parkins backed down as the room got loud again, and I didn't like the way some of the reporters were looking my way. I will make a statement about the Chernyakova, Mr. Parkins, I said quietly. That got their attention, and all the recorders focused on me. The Chernyakova was a tragedy. I think it's probably a matter of record that the crew died, leaving the ship unattended but underway and in transit in a heavily trafficked shipping lane. The CPJCT issued a hazard to navigation warning, and my ship was the first that was able to respond. Yes, we filed a salvage claim. Yes, we boarded the vessel and got it back under control. Yes, the TIC investigated. Yes, I led the crew that sailed the ship back to Baikal. I paused, letting that all sink in a bit. The only sound was the low hum of the air blowers. I'm uncertain as to how much of what happened aboard the vessel is public record, so I cannot say much more without permission of the authorities, but I reiterate. The Chernyakova was a tragedy. If we hadn't intercepted the ship and boarded her, if we had failed to stabilize her course and trajectory, the Chernyakova might have plowed into some other vessel out there in the deep dark. Now, I can't say that we actually prevented that, because that's speculation. We don't know that it would have hit another ship. It's a big dark universe out there, and it might have slipped beyond the limits of our navigational channels and disappeared. They were all looking at me, many with long faces, and Parkin still glowered. But because we brought that ship under control and returned it to Brakel, the families and loved ones of that entire crew at least know what happened to their sisters and brothers and wives and husbands. The ship just didn't disappear into the deep dark, never to be seen or heard from again. Those families and loved ones, as devastated as they are, don't have to spend the rest of their lives wondering what happened. I paused to get a breath. You asked how it makes me feel, Mr. Parkins? It makes me feel terrible to know that the entire crew died. It reinforces my resolve to make sure that nothing like that ever happens on my ship. But I'm also glad that, in the face of this horrible tragedy, I was in the right place, at the right time, with the right skills, to prevent that tragedy from becoming any worse than it already was. Because spending your life not knowing, Mr. Parkins, for all those families and loved ones left behind, Mr. Parkins, that would have been much, much worse. I took another deep breath and looked around at the reporters. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I appreciate your time and attention. I think I've answered enough questions for the moment, and I bid you good day. I turned and left the stage. Miss Arione got the door open in time for me to walk through it, with Mr. Simpson hot on my heels. Miss Arione closed the door firmly behind us just as the hubbub started to build. Mr. Simpson stood there looking at me with an odd look on his face. Sorry, Mr. Simpson, I probably shouldn't have said anything and let them think what they wanted. They'll have that speech carved up and re-spliced inside of a stand, and who knows what I'll wind up saying. His wrinkly face seemed to fold in a grin. Who cares, my boy? He clapped me on the shoulder. Wentworth will scream when he finds out he's missed out on this one. He cackled and nodded. Oh, yes, this will be fun to watch. Miss Arione looked back and forth between the two of us and cast the occasional glance at the door behind us. Mr. Simpson's good humor eventually dissipated, and he nodded in satisfaction, looking up at me, still grinning. Are you still here, Captain? I thought you had a shipping company to run. As we finished up our meal, the attention from the far end of the counter became more intense. The two workmen even called Seth over and showed him their copy of the newsie. He looked at it, looked at us, looked at it again, and I could see him reading it. He was about to give it back when he stopped and did a double take. He said something to the guy at the counter, who nodded. Be ready, Miss Arione murmured. Miss Maloney holstered her tablet, picked up a coffee cup, sipping from it sparingly, and carefully not looking at the developing situation behind the counter. Seth took the newsie and leaned into the kitchen. Even over the hubbub, I could hear him say, Hey, Frank! From our angle, I couldn't see into the kitchen, but Seth leaned over and thrust the newsie through it, presumably holding it so Frank could see. Seth nodded to something and then turned his head to look at us. Yeah, right over there. I couldn't so much hear him as see it on his lips. A head poked out through the pass-through and looked in our direction. I realized then it was the first time I'd ever seen Frank's face. He'd always had his back turned, head down, working on the grill. In all the Stanyards, I'd been on Diurnia. After all the meals I'd eaten there, I realized I'd never seen his face. Time to go, Miss Arione said and started to rise. The chief started to rise, but I said no. It was command voice no, and both Miss Arione and the chief froze as those eyes stared at me. Frank withdrew his head, and I panted a little for breath. Stay, I said, just as the swinging door opened and Frank stepped out of the back and walked over to the table, his eyes on me. He stood there for a moment, the newsie clasped in his hand and a tentative smile on his face. You're Captain Wong, he asked. I am. I could barely speak. Ishmael Horatio Wong. I nodded. He took a deep breath. He started to say something, but changed it to Frank Wong. I smiled. Franklin Prescott Wong? He nodded, and I could see what might be tears forming. Terrible timing, Captain. Breakfast rush and all. I can see that, sir. Perhaps I could come back later, or you could visit the ship when you get off. He nodded, and we became aware of the pool of silence that surrounded us. Seth and Phil looked at each other and shrugged. Yes. I'd like that. He paused, then added, I have to get back to work. I do too, sir. He turned and started for the door, but stopped before he got there. How's your mother? I shook my head. Passed away. Decades gone. Something left him then, and he seemed to deflate a little. This afternoon, I'll come to your ship, and maybe we can talk. I'd like that, sir. Which one is yours? A maintenance dock 3. Iris. He arched an eyebrow and grinned. With a nod, he disappeared back through the door, and the spell broke. "Okay, crew, as soon as I pay this tab, we need to get out of here before some wise guy decides to get snap-happy." I waved a hand at Phil, who got the hint and brought the tab for me to thumb. The chief led the way out, and in a matter of two ticks, we were in the lift, heading for the ship. Nobody said anything, but the curious glances from Miss Arione were becoming quite heavy. Finally, the chief muttered, "I can't believe you know Frank." I chuckled, and they looked at me. "I don't," I said.
"Sure seemed like it to me, Cap. Anybody knows your middle name, seems like they know you."
I shook my head. "I used to know him, I think. A long time ago."
"You think, Skipper?" Miss Arione asked.
"I was 4 the last time I saw him, Miss Arione. I don't remember much about it."
4? As in 4 Stanyards old?
Miss Maloney regarded me with an oddly contemplative look.
"You haven't seen your father since you were 4.
"That's correct, Miss Maitland. If you don't count the 15 Stanyards I've been eating it over easy." And looking at the back of his head. Miss Arione took the lead, as she was wont to do. She still saw herself as our bodyguard, even though none of us still operated as if we needed one. Nobody in his right mind takes on a pack of 4 spacers. Miss Maloney and Greta walked arm in arm, with their heads together, giggling over something that I assumed I would learn about soon enough, given the occasional grins and glances they both gave me. I tried not to worry too much about it, although I harbored more than a little curiosity as I ambled along in the rear. The promenade was sparsely populated in the middle evening hours. It wasn't late enough to be fashionable, and we made up the trailing edge of the early crowd. Maybe that's why I spotted him moving up behind us, not running, but walking with a purposeful stride, as if he had somewhere to go. At first, I didn't recognize him. He was just another spacer in a threadbare gray ship suit wearing a Tyvek painter's coverall. He walked up beside me, on the side closest to the bulkhead, which made me look at him more closely, perhaps. His black, spacer-cropped hair looked wrong somehow, but before I could register it, I felt a sharp burn in my side and looked down to see gaping wounds sliced just under my ribcage and blood already soaking the fabric. I gasped from the combined pain and surprise. Greta and Miss Maloney turned to look just as he made his move. I saw his right arm begin to extend toward Miss Maloney's exposed kidney, but then she had turned enough to see the blood soaking my side and dodged away from the figure coming up fast behind her. Greta had seen what I had, and her eyes opened wide in shock as she recognized the face. What followed was less a smooth flow of time, as much a series of flashes, frames in some horror show. Sound didn't register, because each frame took no time. The entire series unfolded in silence. Flash! Greta's face twisted in shock and surprise as she pulled Christine Maloney away from the approaching blade. Flash! Stacy Arione's head turned to look back over her shoulder as she reached for her own weapons. Flash! A second Tyvek-suited figure stepping from a doorway ahead, blade in hand already driving upward toward Stacy's chest. Flash! Christine Maloney fell to the deck, dodging the thrust from behind, her momentum pulling Greta over on top of her. Flash! My vision blurred as the man's flat ceramic blade streaked forward so fast it was barely recognizable, and buried itself just under Greta's left shoulder blade as she fell over Christine Maloney. Flash! The rictus of anger on Stacy Arione's face as she engaged her own attacker, an arc of silver steel in each hand. Flash! His forward momentum forced our attacker to step over the tangle of limbs on the deck, and he slammed into Miss Arione's exposed back, his second knife carving, his attack throwing her bodily into the bulkhead, even as her first attacker stepped back from the fight, streaks of red slashed diagonally across his torso. Time became fluid and linear again, but the shock and blood loss drew me down to land in the puddles of red on the deck. As my head bounced on the decking, sound crashed around me and shouts echoed down the promenade. I was left with one final vision of irritation flashing across our attacker's face, even as he reached his blade forward to cut the life from his surprised accomplice. As the darkness edged out my vision, I watched our attacker coldly assessing the situation, while the sound of my own heart gushed in my ears. He considered our party, lying sprawled and tangled on the deck, only Christine Maloney uninjured. He glanced up once as the alarm spread loudly behind and around us, his lips pressed together in a line of irritation as his mental calculus reached a solution. I felt the vibrations of running feet where my face lay against the deck, and I watched as Percival Herring turned, walked away down the promenade, and disappeared into the stairwell. Through the din, through the pounding in my ears, and even as the darkness closed my vision, I heard the latch click as the door swung closed behind him. But there was something about it that appealed to me in a perverse way. Why should I sell? She sighed and looked down into her cup for a few heartbeats before looking me in the face. Sympathy floated in her eyes. Because you're only going through the motions here. Because what started out as a wonderful adventure, a new life for you and Greta, has been snatched away. She leaned toward me and smiled. Having spent a few days in my father's residence after he died, I have some idea about what you must go through every time you go into engineering, every time you go into the cabin. I sighed and nodded, unable to speak past the sudden lump in my throat. She gave a sideways shrug and a wry smile. You've helped me see my future with new eyes, Captain. The least I can do is help you on your way to yours. You don't think my future is on the bridge?
Maybe.
Just not this bridge. That strange sense of looking at myself through a camera outside the ship came back. While some small voice in my head screamed, the rest of me couldn't rouse enough feelings to respond with more than a grunt. Instead, I focused on the practicalities. Will you need a few days in port to establish your position with DST? If it would be convenient to plan for an extended stay, Captain, that will give me time to pitch the idea to the board. Maybe between now and our arrival you can work out what it is I'll be pitching. I looked at her dumbly. If you don't want to sell, I'll still want to work on the Iris, Captain. It's the restaurant I've always wanted to have. It seems funny for a rich kid to say, but the dilettante lifestyle has never appealed to me. She paused, considering me for a moment. It really is up to you, Captain. I just wanted to let you know you have options. I nodded my thanks, unable to speak. With a smile, she stood and slipped from the bridge, leaving me sitting in the command chair of a life I no longer recognized. The idea that I might sell off my ship so soon after getting it seemed wrong. But the thought of spending the rest of my life being reminded of my failures, of Greta, seemed worse. I sat there, contemplating the deep dark, feeling whipsawed by indecision for Stanmore. In the end, the decision washed over me as soon as I stepped back into the cabin, and it felt right as sinking into a hot bath. In the end, it wasn't the money, or the position on the ship. It wasn't some nebulous notion of quitting when things got tough and the feeling that I should be tougher or more resilient or more determined. One might argue that I could have been smarter, but hindsight is a useless guide to the past. At best, it gives us lessons we need to take into the future. The unavoidable truth lay in the emptiness of a cabin that had once, if, oh, so very briefly, been filled with possibility. Chapter 81. Diurnia Orbital, January 1, 2374. I pulled the last ship suit out of my grav trunk and laid it on the pile on the bed. The two trunks yawned, and the cabin looked like a rummage sale had exploded in it. I snickered a little at the mess. At the point where I should have been packing to leave the ship, I unpacked everything I owned. Well, I love what you've done with the place, Skipper. I turned to see Miss Arione standing in the door, eyeing the shambles. Her eyes were no longer rimmed with dark circles, but she still looked haunted. After Greta's death, she'd been racked with the guilt of failure. I'd been so lost in my own fog that it had fallen to Chief Stevens and Ms. Maloney to help her through it. I shook my head, surveying the mess. There's stuff in here I'd forgotten I had. Are you going to get rid of it? I scanned the room, surveying the collected artifacts of 2 decades as a spacer. Some of it, I said. There's no need to carry around worn-out ship suits and boxers with no stretch left in the waist. She nodded at the obviousness of it, and her eyes skipped lightly around the room. I tried to see the piles as she might be seeing them, a few decent sets of civilian attire, 3 mounds of ship suits and 4 pairs of ship boots in various states of decrepitude. I sighed. It's not very impressive when it's all laid out like that. She laughed. A small pile of objects decorated the desk, and her eyes were drawn to the collection. I followed her gaze, and a rough bundle reminded me of a task I needed to do. I crossed to the desk and unrolled the welkies. "Come see what you think of these, Miss Arione." Her eyes wrinkled with curiosity, and she picked her way through the mess, and then widened as I pulled the first of the small figures out of its cloth-wrapped cocoon, laying it down on the desk and unwrapping the next. When I finished with the last one, I stepped back. "What do you think, Miss Arione?" "When you said you had a welkie, Captain, I thought you meant a welkie, as in one. You didn't tell me you had a whole pile." She never looked up from the desk. Her gaze darted from figure to figure to figure. She focused on one and started to reach for it, but stopped and looked over at me. "May I?" "Of course." The figure was a badger, resting on its haunches, sitting almost upright with its head turned to look to the left as if it had just heard a sound. "It's lovely, Captain." She smiled, really smiled, not the half-formed rictus approximating a smile that I'd seen on her face for weeks. "What is it?" "It's a badger. Ornery little beasts from Earth. They're tough enough to survive in a variety of climates and conditions, and they make excellent niche dwellers on terraforming operations." "He's kind of cute," she said. "He's yours," I told her. She looked at me in shock. "No, Captain, I couldn't possibly." I handed her the bit of soft cloth he'd been wrapped in all that time, and the length of red string he'd been tied with. "It's already done, Miss Arione." For the first time in our acquaintance, I saw Miss Arione speechless. Her mouth opened and closed a couple of times, and she looked from me to the badger and back to me again before she was able to get her jaw under control. "Are you sure, Skipper? I was just admiring it." She started to put it back down on the desk where she'd found it. "Do you know the story of the Welkies, Miss Arione?" My question stopped her. "Not really, Skipper, just that they're really rare and are some kind of good luck charm." "They're carved on a planet called St. Cloud, over in the Dunsany Roads quadrant. The shaman who live on the south coast collect driftwood and carve the figures. There's an indigenous snail, a whelk, that lives in the tide pools, and the shells have a purple color. Some are dark purple, and some have just a bare wash of color. Story is, the darker the hue, the more powerful the whelkie." She held the carving up to see the bit of shell embedded on the badger's chest as a heart. "Is that what this is?" "Yes, Miss Arione." "This one's really purple. How purple do they get?" "I don't know, but that's on the upper end of the scale." She looked over at me again. "But what do they do? Power for what?" "I don't know. The story is that the Welkie finds its owner and the person it's supposed to go to. Usually it's given out by the village shaman to somebody who needs strength or guidance." She arched an eyebrow in my direction. I snorted a laugh. "Yes, well, it's just a story." "Do people believe it?" she asked. I drew in a deep breath and let it out slowly as I considered. "Some do, some don't. Mostly the skeptics dismiss it as religious mumbo-jumbo. What do you think, Skipper?" "I think I've carried my dolphin for Stanyers. There's something soothing about holding the wood. I don't feel like I'm influenced by some supernatural force or anything, but perhaps it serves as a kind of centering device, a physical manifestation of focus." She thought about that for a few heartbeats and then looked down at the collection on the desk again. "You must have needed a lot of guidance, Skipper." I laughed and felt something cold and brittle snap inside me. "Yes, well, these aren't my guides. They weren't given to me." "Where did you get them?" Her brow furrowed in confusion. "Stanyers ago, on a trip through St. Cloud on the Lois McKendrick, back before I went to the academy, I found a guy in the flea market there who sold them to me." "I thought you said they had to be given." "Yes, well, and that was before I knew what they were, and I bought 10 of them for private trading goods. I just have never been able to sell one." "Well, some trader you are, Skipper." She twitted me even as she held her badger up close to her face. I chuckled and she looked over at me. "So, how long have you been lugging this around?" I tried to add up the Stanyers and I couldn't. "Since before the academy, maybe 20 Stanyers." She blinked in astonishment. "That long?" She looked closely at the shell, turning it so the light gleamed. "Do you suppose it still got power?" "As much as it ever did, probably." She gave me one of her exasperated glances and then nodded at the collection on the desk. "Looks like you've got your work cut out for you." I looked at the remaining figures. "My work?" She nodded, perfectly straight-faced, and zinged me. "At the rate you're giving these out, You're going to be an old, old man before you're done. I laughed then, for what might have been the first time in weeks, maybe a stanier. The warmth of it accelerated the thawing inside me that the daily sessions of Tai Chi with Chief Stevens had started. She looked pleased with herself, and that felt good, too. "What's all this jocularity?" Miss Maloney asked from the doorway. She wore a smartly tailored business suit and had just returned from a meeting ashore. "Miss Arione has been pointing out how old I'm getting," I told her.
"Seasoned, Captain, not old," Miss Maloney told me with a grin of her own.
She saw the spread of Welkies on the desk and gasped.
"Great, merciful Maud! How many of those do you have?"
"Well, that's my entire collection, not counting this one." I pulled a dolphin from my pocket. My eyes snagged on the seabird that had belonged to Greta. I picked that one up from where it rested beside my console. "And this one." She snickered but crossed to lean down and look at the figures.
"You've got more Welkies in one place than I've ever seen before."
She frowned as she examined them. "This might be the largest private collection in existence outside of St. Cloud." She looked up at me with a speculative grin. "You want to sell them?"
"No, these aren't for sale."
"Pity," she said, and resumed her study, carefully looking at each one. When she finished her examination, she stood and raised a hand to her mouth with a pensive frown. "There are at least two, if not three, different artists' work here. Do you know who they are?" I shook my head. I thought they were all by the same guy.
"I don't think so."
She pointed to the seabird and the dolphin that I held. "Those two are obviously different from each other, but look at the details around the eyes for these." I leaned down and looked closely. "Some don't have eyes."
"That's my point.
The details are different, even though they all have a similar kind of overall technique with a smooth, flowing line." She pursed her lips. "No, I'm pretty sure that there are at least three artists here, and a fourth, counting your seabird there." I looked at the Welkies in my hands, the dolphin's smooth wood burnished to a high sheen from my constant handling of it over the Staniers, the seabird's stylized feathers giving the piece unique texture in the carving. I looked up to see Miss Maloney looking at the dolphin, a slight frown of concentration on her face. I held it out to her. "Would you like to see it?" She nodded, and I handed it to her. She did what every other person who ever held it had done. She held it in her hand and stroked the smooth back with the ball of one fingertip. She then held it up, turning her hand back and forth to watch the light shine on the wood and across the shell. "This is a spectacular piece, Captain." Miss Arione watched curiously from the side, and I could see her looking at the dolphin and then at the expression on Miss Maloney's face. "Would you like to have it?" I asked, surprised by the question as much as she was. The shock on her face was clear.
"Captain?
That Welkie. Would you like to have it?" I looked at the collection on the desk.
"You can have any of them you want, if there's one there you like."
She glanced at the collection, but her fingers curled around the dolphin, and she turned back to look at me. "But, Captain, this is yours." I shook my head and held up the seabird.
"This is mine."
"You can have the dolphin if you like."
"You can't be serious, Captain. This is priceless."
I thought about that for a few heartbeats, watching her face, seeing the dolphin already cupped protectively in her fingers. It had been with me for 20 Staniers, seen me through the academy, all through my career up through the ranks. Somehow, it seemed fitting to leave it with her. Something in that moment, letting go of the past, accepting a future where I might spread my wings and fly, where I wanted to go, instead of being maneuvered and manipulated into taking the actions that would define my life. Something in that moment clicked into place with a nearly audible snap. I could feel my lips curling into a smile. "Yes, I am."
"And it is," I said.
"But since I'm no longer your captain, please, call me Ishmael."